Welcome to the First Guardian Daily of 2009. It's Monday, the 5th of January. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, as Israeli troops surround Gaza City, we ask what can be done to stop the bloodshed.
There does have to be some agreement to stop all this happening again. If everything is simply left in place, then a lot of people will have died, and there'll be no guarantee that it can't happen again.
We'll bring you the latest on the incursion and the diplomatic response. Also in the podcast...
I mean, it's all rather boring, I know, but the answer really is cut out the booze, do a bit more exercise, definitely cut out the fags. In a couple of weeks, you'll be fine. You don't need to spend your money on these things.
Don't believe the hype. Scientists warn that detox products could be misleading. And we get the lowdown on Gallifrey's new favourite son, Doctor Who. First, a news update and a review of today's papers with Sandy Waugh.
International pressure to secure a ceasefire in Gaza is growing as aid agencies warn of a humanitarian disaster. Israeli tanks and troops seized control of large parts of the Gaza Strip yesterday with relentless artillery and gunfire, killing at least 40 more civilians, including children. Reports say people in the region are facing grave shortages of food and water. We'll have more on this story in a moment. Labour and the Conservatives will lay out their plans on how to deal with the economy later. David Cameron will use a speech to claim the longer Labour are in charge, the worse the nation's financial situation will become. Meanwhile, Gordon Brown will discuss help for businesses during the economic slowdown. Yesterday, the Prime Minister told The Observer that he planned to create 100,000 jobs. As he moved to Washington from his hometown of Chicago last night, Barack Obama had his first serious setback since winning the presidency. Obama's proposed Secretary of Commerce, Bill Richardson, has been forced to leave the cabinet because of a federal investigation into a business deal. Richardson, governor of New Mexico and the most high-profile Latino politician in the US, issued a statement saying he'd done nothing wrong and expected to be cleared. India's foreign ministry says authorities have provided evidence to Pakistan linking the deadly Mumbai attacks to Pakistani elements. The November attacks that killed 164 people have been blamed by India on Pakistani-based militants. Pakistan's denied the accusations, calling for definitive proof. The evidence includes the interrogation of the lone surviving gunman and details of conversations between the gunman and their alleged handlers. Football in Liverpool will face Merseyside rivals Everton in the pick of the FA Cup fourth round matches later this month. Manchester United will host Tottenham, while non-league Kettering Town will meet Premier League Fulham and giant killers Hartlepool host West Ham. The fourth round ties will be played over the weekend of the 23rd of January. Now for a look at today's papers, and all the broadsheets are leading on Gaza. The Times reports that Israel may be using white phosphorus shells in its campaign. The weapon, also used by British forces in Iraq, can cause horrific burns to anyone caught beneath it. The Telegraph has a picture of their two journalists being released by kidnappers in Somalia after a 40-day ordeal. The paper also reports the actor David Tennant is returning to perform Hamlet in London's West End. The Doctor Who star's been recovering from a back injury. The Daily Mail reveals that sexual health clinics could soon be open in every secondary school in the country. After an initial trial in a third of schools, a study's recommended all pupils should have easy access to emergency contraception and confidential pregnancy testing. And the Daily Express says Britain could be in the grip of its coldest winter for decades as temperatures plummeted to -9 degrees yesterday. But they do bring us some sunny pictures of Sir Paul McCartney frolicking on a beach in Mexico with his girlfriend Nancy Chevelle. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
No let-up in the offensive on the Gaza Strip over the weekend. Tanks and Israeli ground forces moved further into Palestinian territory surrounding Gaza City. Airstrikes have left dozens dead and hundreds more injured. Back home, thousands of protesters have been gathering outside London's Israeli embassy to voice opposition to the Israeli incursion. The Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, has joined the calls for a ceasefire.
I've talked on three occasions in the last few days to Ehud Olmert, the Prime Minister of Israel. David Miliband has been talking to the Defence Minister, Mr Barak, and to Mrs Livni. We have continued to talk to them about what are the guarantees that they need for the action to stop. the Arab powers have got to put the pressure on that is necessary. Stop the supply of arms. Make sure that the tunnels that are being used for the illegal passing of arms into Gaza are closed. And we do something to reopen the crossings, which of course would mean that there would be a flow of people and goods in, but done on a properly monitored basis. Now, I sense that the Arab powers are as worried as we are about the turn of events.
We'll hear the international reaction in a moment, but first to our correspondent Chris McGreal, who's been following the conflict for The Guardian. On a poor phone line from Jerusalem, we asked him, what is next? When will the bomb stop and the talking start?
I think the Israelis will push on with their ground offensive, not least because even despite the ground incursion beginning on Saturday night, in the 24 hours since the tanks first went in, we've had at least 30 Hamas rockets fired out of Gaza and into Israel. And I think that the Israeli government would be pretty unwilling to come to any kind of agreement for a ceasefire whilst those rockets are still being fired, because it's going to look like a defeat and as though they have not achieved their mission. I think the Israelis probably are, though, working on the basis that they have a phase in which to hit the Palestinians hard before the diplomatic pressure will grow intensely for some kind of agreed truce.
Hamas say that Israel have played into their hands. Is the Israeli incursion really part of their game plan?
It's not clear whether Hamas expected such a large incursion, and particularly the ground incursion. I think they could have predicted that there would be the week of air bombardment that we saw, but the scale of the attack must be something of a surprise to them, because we haven't seen that in quite a long time, certainly not since the Israelis pulled Jewish settlements and their military bases out of Gaza. That said, I think that Hamas must have expected that there would be a fairly significant response to them resuming the rocket attacks, at least on the scale that they did after the breakdown of the ceasefire before Christmas. And I think that Hamas now will be trying to exact the highest casualty toll that they can from the Israelis in order to be able to turn this into a victory, even if it is also at a very high cost for Palestinian civilians.
Finally, Chris, Hamas has had support from Palestinians up until this point, but with the rising casualties, how long can that last?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, Palestinians in Gaza, particularly in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, are having a very tough time of it right now. They're living at night in darkness. They're under perpetual shell fire. It's dangerous, even if you live in the heart of the city, to venture out. The market was hit. 5 people were killed by an Israeli shell. I think that large numbers of people are traumatized. The United Nations are calling this a catastrophe. They're saying people are traumatized and terrorized. They have no electricity or water. Life is extremely difficult, even for those who aren't on the front line of the fighting. And I think right now, many of those people will voice support for Hamas. There is a solidarity issue. But once the dust settles and they have time to reflect on what the causes of this were and Hamas's actions, I suspect there will be a number of Palestinians who will probably conclude that actually Hamas has not been acting in their best interests, and this is not really what they want to happen.
In America, the Bush administration is blaming Hamas as it continues to fire rockets into Israel. And President George W. Bush is saying what you might expect him to say.
In the days ahead, the United States will stay closely engaged with our partners in the region, in Europe, and in the international community. We seek security and peace for our allies, the free people of Israel. For the Palestinian people, we seek a peaceful and democratic Palestinian state that serves its citizens and respects its neighbors. For all in the region, we seek an end to terror, and we seek an enduring peace based on justice, dignity, and human rights for every person in every nation of the Middle East.
The Israeli president, Shimon Peres, has rejected calls for a ceasefire, saying he doesn't intend to occupy Gaza, nor to crush Hamas, but to crush terror. We can speak to The Guardian's Middle East editor Ian Black now. We've heard from George Bush, but there's an expectation to hear from President-elect Obama. So far, though, he's remained mute.
The problem is that Obama's silence is becoming quite damaging in the sense that there have been such high expectations of him, particularly in the Middle East, that he would make a difference to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And here we are 2 weeks away from his inauguration, and the thing has blown up into one of the biggest crises we've seen in years. It's clear that his failure to say anything has had the effect of not only lowering expectations of him, but making Arabs in particular angry, that the reaction is as if nothing has changed. And of course, in a sense, it hasn't. And the problem with Obama is that for constitutional reasons, he can't be president at the same time as George Bush is still president. Thus, the silence he's maintaining. I think that the only thing that can be said for this grim situation is that by the time Obama does become president on January the 20th, then hopefully this bloodletting will be over and everybody involved will realize just how very urgent it is for the only superpower on the planet to take a strong, close and relentless interest in trying to make some progress towards a peace settlement, because this will have been a very, very bloody reminder of what happens if there's no hope of a settlement.
Well, can this situation wait 2 weeks to hear from Obama?
Well, it clearly can't wait because it's very grave, but it may have to. The feeling is, I think, that while there's a flurry of international diplomatic activity that's been galvanized by the Israeli ground offensive into Gaza, there is a sense, I think, that this thing has still to run some kind of course. We're seeing a huge amount of activity, a flurry of high-level delegations and individuals visiting. There is a high-ranking delegation from the European Union. The Russians have sent somebody. We've heard Gordon Brown here in London repeating Britain's call for an immediate ceasefire and issuing a pretty stark warning about the consequences of this violence. But we haven't seen any lessening of military action, not on the Israeli side and not by Hamas fighting in the Gaza Strip. And I think that what we can see is that everybody knows more or less how this crisis is going to end. It's going to be some sort of restoration of the ceasefire that was allowed to expire in the middle of December. But it doesn't seem that the conditions for that are quite ripe yet.
You mentioned Gordon Brown. He has been joined by thousands of protesters over the weekend. Will their voices be heard at all?
Well, I think their voices are heard, and I think there's a very strong awareness globally of how serious this crisis is. But we've seen that at the very highest level of the United Nations, it has not been possible to come up with a clear response to this because people disagree about how it is to be ended. People are talking about an immediate ceasefire, and the United States, which of course has veto power at the UN, says, well, it's all very well calling for an immediate ceasefire, but we need to ensure a situation that doesn't go back to what we were before, where Hamas were firing rockets into Israel. I think we will see over the coming days, and I don't know how long it will take, I think we will see a ratcheting up of that international pressure, and I think we will see an emerging consensus of the need to impose a ceasefire. But there is always the sense, and it's very similar to what happened in Lebanon in 2006, that the United States in particular is favorable towards Israel, accepts Israel's point about the need to reduce the threat of rocket fire, and that the U.S. will delay that sort of concerted action, which it can otherwise block. And it clearly is the case that there does have to be some agreement to stop all this happening again. If everything is simply left in place, then a lot of people will have died, and there'll be no guarantee that it can't happen again.
Finally, Ian, you mentioned the United Nations. Now, the Czech Republic has just taken over the presidency of the EU from France. Are they going to find much agreement across the Union?
The problem with the European Union is that it's so large and unwieldy that it often finds it quite difficult to act. But we've already seen an example of this with the Czech Republic, obviously one of the smaller members of the European Union, taking over the presidency, and remarks from the Czech Republic being interpreted, perhaps overinterpreted, as being favorable to Israel waging a war of defense. This already caused some bristling. The Czechs have said that this, in fact, was a sort of some kind of misunderstanding, that clarifying that even though a state has a right to self-defense, that doesn't justify actions which are largely affecting civilians. So I think that perhaps will have blown over. But the EU is very unwieldy. It's got different countries of different sizes that find it quite hard to do things together. Having said that, I think there is a pretty broad consensus across it of the urgency of a ceasefire, the need for humanitarian action, and for a mechanism to be put in place, I think most important of all, that will stop all this happening again a few weeks after the next, or days after the next ceasefire is agreed.
Ian Black. Elsewhere on the Guardian website today, find out which retailers were Christmas winners and which were Christmas losers at guardian.co.uk/business. Discover which town is set to scrap free parking for Christians at guardian.co.uk/politics. Catch up on the FA Cup winners and losers at guardian.co.uk/football. Plus, you can read the story about the pony who joined filmgoers at the local multiplex. That's guardian.co.uk/culture. You're listening to Guardian Daily. I'm Mike Durand. Still to come, who is this unknown actor who dares to take the role as the new Doctor Who? Before that, we turn to a subject which journalists love to talk about at this time of the year, and they can't think of anything better: detoxing after the Christmas binge. This year, we've been kindly assisted by a group called Sense About Science. They're warning us that manufacturers' claims that their detox products can help us recover from our festive overindulgence are frequently misleading or questionable. Science correspondent James Randerson has been looking at some of the more exaggerated claims.
Well, I think the most outlandish claim of those that have been looked at is a brush which is marketed as a detox brush. And the idea is you brush your skin with it. It cleans your skin, and it also supposedly stimulates your lymphatic system, which supposedly has some good effects. That struck me as being rather, highfalutin perhaps. And then there was another one which suggested that a patch that you put on your foot, which is supposed to kind of suck the nasty toxins out of your system via the sole of your foot, produced infrared radiation because it had a certain kind of mineral in there. And that infrared radiation is what sort of heats up your foot and makes you sweat and hence sucks out the toxins.
Well, we are being told not to believe these claims by companies which, let's face it, have been respectable household names for decades. Who's doing the finger pointing?
Well, the finger pointing comes from a charity called Sense About Science, and they've basically gone through 11 different products that are on the market, all of which are detox products. And I don't know how you feel at the moment, but my body, after sort of 2 weeks of abuse, well, actually all of December probably, feels like I've been in a sack of kangaroos or something. And so it's quite tempting at this time of year to think, right, okay, it's time to really clear out the system and, get fit and regain my healthy equilibrium. And there are all these products out there on the market to do that, which say, you know, you can detox your system, get rid of these nasty toxins that you've been building up by unhealthy living over Christmas. But this charity is saying the sort of sciencey-sounding language that is often deployed to market these products is very often misleading or questionable, and really doesn't reflect the reality of what the products do.
The manufacturers, have they been defending their products?
They have. Some of them, there's a variety of defences, because really the variety of guilt is, well, there's quite a range really, because some of them are just kind of exaggerating the abilities of their products, and some are, to be honest, saying things that the product really just doesn't do. I think the main point, though, that Sense About Science is making is that most of the time these products are either just cleaning, so that the brush probably is just cleaning you, and to call that detox is really, just a bit of an exaggeration, really. And others are, there are quite a few which are sort of drinks that have vitamins and minerals in, or they're pills or kind of sort of formulations that you make up by adding water that you take for 5 days or that kind of thing, which are supposed to have lots of goodies in which are good for your body. And, you know, none of it probably does much harm, but what they're saying is that there isn't really good, hard scientific evidence that they really do anything very much. I mean, you know, what hasn't been done, by and large, is a kind of clinical trial where you sort of give one set of people your product and another set of people a sort of placebo, and neither side knows, you know, which is getting the real thing. And then at the end of it, you say, right, who's most detoxed? And, you know, you kind of measure the amount of nasty things in their system. Nobody really does that typically with these products, because they tend not to be marketed as actual medicines. They're marketed as sort of food supplements and things like that. They're all a bit more fluffy, and so you can get away with saying things about the product which you wouldn't be able to get away with medicines. And so, you know, Sense About Science are saying, you know, all this language about detox is pretty much, well, just misleading, and you might as well save your money.
If we are not to believe some of these products, how do we detox? Could it be as simple as cutting out booze and chocolate and cigarettes? Maybe leave the rest to your kidneys?
We have a very effective detox system, which has evolved over thousands of years and is the combination of our liver and kidneys, basically. And, I mean, it's all rather boring, I know, but the answer really is cut out the booze, do a bit more exercise, definitely cut out the fags, and eat a healthy diet, and, you know, in a couple of weeks you'll be fine. You don't need to spend your money on these things.
James Randerson. You can read the full list of products in James's article, plus the manufacturer's statements, at guardian.co.uk/science.
Guardian Daily on guardian.co.uk.
Finally, to the most talked about TV series of the year so far, this January the 5th. Doctor Who fans have had a day or so to take in the news that a 26-year-old will be the latest to play the 903-year-old Doctor. Matt Smith will take over from David Tennant when he steps down from the role later this year. The Northampton-born actor will become the youngest to play the Time Lord. The Guardian's Helen Pidd has been reading through the Doctor Who blogs to see what the fans think of the Silurians and Zygons' new deadliest enemy.
Well, Doctor Who's armies of fans have been waiting for the moment to arrive. So literally the second Matt Smith's name came up, they all rushed online and they went to the biggest Doctor Who forum, which promptly crashed. So when I tried to log on to see what they were all saying, there was this very sort of po-faced message written in a red font saying that they had to go into sort of emergency mode and they'd shut down the website. Only patrons could get into the website. And to be a patron, you had to be like an uber geek. So only the real fans could get in, and sort of dilettantes like me couldn't get in.
So once you managed to get in, what were they saying?
Well, the initial reaction from the blogs was, who the hell is this guy? Apparently nobody watched the BBC Two political drama Party Animals, in which he starred. So there's much discussion. I've never heard of him. They were all hoping it was going to be somebody entirely different, Catherine Zeta-Jones or somebody like that. And then very quickly they started getting rather personal in their insults. They don't like his hair. His hair is deemed too foppish, it's too floppy, and it's just not Doctor Who-ish.
Well, I did read one critic who said that he was Byronic in looks and very sensual, in fact.
Well, if you like that kind of thing, then I suppose
so. This critic did.
But, I mean, reading some of the comments here, I mean, somebody had said, well, I'm happy as long as he has a haircut before he plays the Doctor. Somebody here, a very disgruntled woman who calls herself Sarah Jane Lover, says, I'm not too thrilled about him. I don't know who he is and I don't like the look of him. But time will tell. It always does.
What about his age? I did read on the Guardian website a blog there saying one of the bloggers was disturbed that the Tory leader was younger than him, but this is a youth too far. Though he did sign off, what does he know? He's old and in the way.
Well, yeah, he's 26. And he's the youngest Doctor Who ever. And this guy does actually look quite a lot younger than he is. So one of the bloggers was suggesting that it could be a kind of Asbo youth. He could be wearing a hoodie. That could be the theme of the new Doctor Who, you know?
And do we know if he'll get a companion? Another Guardian blogger suggested Cheryl Cole.
But, I mean, everybody loves Cheryl Cole. The BBC will have a real, that would be a real scoop, wouldn't it, if they managed to get her?
Well, being as the doctor is not a woman, because that, of course, was talked about before the announcement of Matt Smith, all black, and no Obama effect hitting Doctor Who.
Yeah, I mean, some people were quite disappointed about that, that it's another skinny, sort of spiky-haired, pale young thing. But, you know, but maybe we should trust Stephen Moffat, who is the new writer of the series. He says that this guy's perfect.
Helen Pidd on the hard-to-please Doctor Who fanatics. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. John Dennis returns tomorrow from 7:30. Producing today, Ben Green and Ian Chambers. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.